I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Dinner Time. At a fundraiser for Catholic Charities in New York, former President Trump speaks to the crowd while Vice President Harris sends a video message. War in the Middle East. What Hamas and Israel are saying after the killing of terror leader Yahya Sinwar. Plus, we hear from Gershon Baskin on the peace effort being led by Pope Francis. And the numbers are in. A new Vatican study reveals how many Catholics there are around the world. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Luke the Evangelist. Our top story tonight, we begin on the campaign trail. Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump are both campaigning in Michigan today, each candidate holding multiple events there. Last night, Trump was at the Al Smith dinner in New York City, where EWTN's Raymond Arroyo got an exclusive interview with the former president. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
That's right, Tracy. Good evening to you. Donald Trump responded to some critically important questions on abortion, IVF, religious freedom, and more.
And your record of religious liberty, how important is that to you, religious liberty?
It's a stance that I've taken from the beginning, and I'll keep it. I wouldn't change it for anything.
EWTN's Raymond Arroyo also asked former President Donald Trump about abortion funding.
Will you reinstate the Mexico City policy, which forbids international spending on abortion?
Well, I was the only one that did that, as you know. Yeah. No other president did that. And we're going to be giving that a very good, serious look. In other words, how that compares right. And competes with the states. But we'll be giving that a very serious look.
And on IVF, in vitro fertilization, which the Catholic Church says is immoral, Trump indicated he'd be in favor of religious exemptions for those opposed to the procedure.
Will you have a religious exemption to your IVF mandate for religious organizations and businesses that feel this violates my religious principles?
Well, you know, I haven't been asked that, but it sounds to me like a pretty good idea, frankly. But even Catholics, a lot of them, they want IVF. It's fertilization, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they view that as helping a family, helping parents have a child.
Moments later, Trump appeared at the Al Smith Catholic Charity Dinner.
Tradition holds that I'm supposed to tell a few self-deprecating jokes this evening. So here it goes. Nope, I've got nothing. I guess I just don't see the point of taking shots at myself when other people have been shooting at me for a hell of a long time and they shoot up.
Vice President Kamala Harris drew criticism for declining to attend. Instead, she submitted a video message alongside a former SNL star.
Is there anything that you think that maybe I shouldn't bring up tonight?
Well, don't lie. Thou shalt not bear false witness to thy neighbor.
Indeed, especially thy neighbor's election results.
Harris spent last night campaigning in Wisconsin. Today, she carried her message to another swing state, Michigan.
When Congress passes a bill to restore the reproductive freedoms nationwide, with your help as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
Now, the Harris campaign criticized Donald Trump's remarks at last night's dinner, saying that he made it all about himself. Trump, meanwhile, holds a rally tonight in Detroit, and there are just 18 days to go until November 5th, Election Day. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
A new biography about Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is drawing a lot of fire. The new book reveals remarks recorded by the longtime Senate power broker to an Associated Press reporter describing then-President Donald Trump as, quote, stupid, ill-tempered, despicable, and narcissistic. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us in the studio with more. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, the book titled The Price of Power. It's expected to be released just a few days before Election Day, but excerpts from the book are already drawing a lot of reaction. It gives insight to Senator Mitch McConnell's frosty relationship with former President Donald Trump, a man he continues to back.
I said in February of 2021, shortly after the attack on the Capitol, that I would support President Trump if he were the nominee of our party, and he obviously is going to be the nominee of our party.
The book is based on nearly three decades of McConnell's recorded diaries and years of interviews conducted by Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of the Associated Press, Michael Tackett, Republican political consultant and former RNC communications director, Lisa Camuso Miller, says it shows a sharp contrast of the Republican Party's direction.
Mitch McConnell has dedicated his entire career to growing and building a strong Republican Party. Donald Trump, over the last 10 years, has done quite the opposite. He's done everything to take over the party in the image of his own self.
She believes if Donald Trump does win the White House and Republicans win the Senate, Trump will have a very different relationship with the new GOP leader than he did during previous administration.
That Republican Senate is still a Senate that is made up of strong, principled Republicans that are made in the image of Mitch McConnell.
Senator McConnell put out a statement defending his comments about President Trump, stating, quote, "Whatever I may have said about President Trump pales in comparison to what J.D. Vance, Lindsey Graham, and others have said about him. But we are all on the same team now."
Political experts in the book that don't believe that McConnell's words in the book will actually hurt the former president. Many knew Trump and McConnell just didn't get along. Also, many have already cast their ballots early in states across the country, like in Georgia, where more than 600,000 people have voted so far. Tracy?
All right. Thank you so much, Eric. Well, there is more on the ballot than voting for the president. Several key congressional races could determine the balance of power on Capitol Hill. Real Clear Politics polling shows several close contests, especially in Montana, Arizona, and in Nevada. Democrat John Tester is in danger of losing his Senate seat in Montana. And Nevada Democrat Jackie Rosen is defending against a Republican challenger, while retiring Senator Kyrsten Sinema's seat is up for grabs in Arizona. All right, now let's bring in Dr. Casey Burgett, Director of the Legislative Affairs Program at the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Great to see you again. All right, so much for us to talk about, but I want to start in Montana. Democrat John Tester is defending his seat against Republican challenger Tim Sheehy. The latest Real Clear Politics average has Sheehy with a 7-point lead. What do you make of this, and what do you think is drawing voters to this GOP newcomer? What are the big issues in Montana?
I think the biggest thing is, how did John Tester hold on this long in Montana, right? This is an incredibly conservative state. It votes at overwhelming majorities for any Republican nominee, Trump, Romney, you name him. And yet John Tester somehow has been able to withstand that conservative voting pressure and still represent the state as a Democratic senator. And so we're all looking at, one, can he hang on again? And if not, by how close is that election? Because that can give us a lot of insight about how strong the Republican ticket is nationwide, or and just how different Montana is to the rest of the conservative base.
All right. Now, I'm going to turn now to Arizona. Senator Kyrsten Sinema's seat is up for grabs, as we mentioned. She is retiring at the end of this term and vying for her seat. Republican Kari Lake and Democrat Ruben Gallego. Let's talk about that race and where things stand right now.
Right now, I think most pollsters have this as a lean Democratic, where you have Ruben Gallego, a current House member, running on the Democratic ticket against Kari Lake, who lost in a last election running for governor. And Kari Lake is in the image of Trump. This is the new Republican Party that your lead mentioned. And so we're testing and looking at, does that message extend beyond Trump himself to one of his disciples in Kari Lake? And she lost that governor's race in an earlier election. And now she's running against a pretty conservative Democrat, but a Democrat nonetheless, in a swing state. So a lot going on there, and we'll get a lot of insight from what voters are caring about in Arizona, which can portend for the rest of the country, especially in these all-important swing states.
All right, moving along to neighboring Nevada, where Democrat incumbent Senator Jackie Rosen is running against Republican Sam Brown. Quickly, tell us about these two candidates who actually faced off in a debate last night. How do you see this race shaking out?
This one's a lot of people are watching, not only because Jackie Rosen's defending her seat in another swing state, but more than that, folks are looking at the Latino vote in Nevada, an increasing population within that state. And there's been some stories and even some polling saying that Trump is pulling that Latino vote away from Democrats and to Republicans. We need to see how much in that election night, which is why a lot of folks are paying attention, not only because it's one Senate seat.
All right, before I let you go, I want to turn out of the House. I know you're following races in Virginia, North Carolina, also in New York. Why are these ones to watch?
For different reasons. And that's the tough thing about the House, is that you look at specific ones to kind of tell you more big picture outside of those district types of trends. And so with Virginia, the Spanberger race, that's just outside the suburbs of Washington, D.C. And that was one that went Trump back into Democrats' hands, and then it's gone back and forth. So it's kind of that swing districts of swing districts, and it's one that represents the suburban moms. And this is what is going to be a huge, important population in all races, especially the presidency. Can Trump win back those suburban moms? Or if it goes into Democratic hands, then Kamala Harris is looking to have a really good night on election night.
All right, we'll leave right there. Dr. Bargett, great to be with you. Thanks so much for weighing in.
Thank you.
All right, now to the Middle East, where Israel and Hamas both say they are no closer to ending the war in Gaza. Hamas adds that following the death of its leader yesterday, the terror group will not release more hostages until there is a ceasefire. Yahya Sinwar was the architect of the October 7 terror attack on Israel. His killing by Israeli forces offers a potential window to shift the dynamic in the war in Gaza. Both Hamas and Hezbollah, another terror group backed by Iran, considered Sinwar a martyr. Hezbollah is vowing a new phase of fighting against Israel. President Biden says a peace deal in Gaza will be difficult.
We think that there's a possibility of working for a ceasefire in Lebanon, and it's going to be harder in Gaza, but we agree that there has to be an outcome. What happens the day after?
And for more, we bring in Gershon Baskin, Middle East peace negotiator and expert on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Gershon, great to have you back on. So there's so much to unpack here. But first, where does the death of Yahya Sinwar leave Hamas? Is there a succession plan in place, or is this the end of the terror group?
No, I'm afraid it's not the end of Hamas as a political and military movement. It has shaken Hamas deeply, but there are people already scrambling for leadership positions. It's doubtful if anyone has the ability, the power, and the control to be Yahya Sinwar, who was killed by Israel. There's no one who can probably be the head of the political division of Hamas and the military division of Hamas. But we will see existing leaders taking control of the movement. And the question is, what direction will they go in? After a war with Israel, after 2 million people homeless in Gaza, Gaza being destroyed, will Hamas start doing some internal accounting and perhaps change their ways? They have declared victory in that they brought the Palestinian issue back to the international agenda. It would be great if they would accept that as a victory and then move on to be a non-military political movement within the Palestinian national cause.
Gershon, I want to talk about Israel. How does the killing of Sinwar change things for them? And what are their options now?
Right. Well, first of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu has the ability, if he wants, to declare victory. He has his victory picture. Sinwar is out of play right now, and there is no one significant in Gaza controlling the military there. So if Prime Minister Netanyahu was interested in ending the war, he would have an ability to do that now. I'm afraid he doesn't want to end the war, and this is where we're stuck. The fate of the hostages is unknown. The hostages could be executed by their captors in Gaza as a result of the Sinwar killing, or Israel could exploit the opportunity of chaos and offer a deal to anyone holding Israeli hostages that they would have free passage out of Gaza with their families and a bundle full of money. This might actually work, and I think the Israelis need to push forward very rapidly in trying to get a deal with Hamas that would free all the hostages and end the war. The question is here, is Israel willing to do it? And secondly, is President Biden willing to use American leverage on Israel to force Israel into a deal that would end the war?
Yeah, I want to switch gears now before I let you go. I know you were part of a delegation of Israelis and Palestinians who met yesterday with Pope Francis. Talk to us about that. How did that meeting come about? And what was it like for you to be a part of it?
Well, my Palestinian colleague Samer Sinjalawi and I have been bringing together the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and a former Palestinian Foreign Minister Nasser Kidwa. Nasser Kidwa is also the nephew of Yasser Arafat and a very senior member of the Palestinian National Movement who supports peace with Israel. We brought them together and they worked on a declaration of intent, a proposal to provide a kind of light forward of where we need to move to bring these two people to make sure this war in Gaza is the last war. And their document is inspiring a lot of people. And we were coming to Rome to meet with the Italian foreign minister. We contacted the Vatican to see if we could have an audience with His Holiness. And of course, he agreed to see them and us and delivered the document to him. And Father Pope Francis said that he would read the document carefully. He would issue a statement. He expressed his support for all efforts for peace. We held a moment of prayer together. And I must say that it was a very spiritual moment. We were in the two former leaders and myself and my colleague, along with Pope Francis and a translator in a room together. And it was a great moment. And you feel the power of this man who is the spiritual leader for a billion people on this planet. It was a very important meeting, and we're quite certain that the Holy Father will come out with a positive statement backing this plan, which is really a way forward for the Israeli and Palestinian people to end up from this war with a genuine chance of reaching peace.
Yeah, and we do pray for that. Gershon, thank you, as always, for your insights. Always appreciated.
Thank you.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including an extremely sad reality. The doctor tells us about the death of thousands of children in Gaza and what he has experienced along the way. Welcome back. The Israel-Hamas war has devastated the Gaza Strip. Airstrikes have destroyed people's homes. Thousands now live in makeshift tents. The landscape is full of bombed-out buildings. Some structures are still partially standing, while others are now just piles of rubble. And what is absolutely evident, say many, is the human suffering. From October 8, 2023 to Wednesday of this week, estimates show more than 42,000 fatalities and nearly 500,000 people facing food insecurity. Meanwhile, almost 2 million people have been displaced and 84% of Gaza has had Israel-issued evacuation orders. Additionally concerning, the number of children killed, more than 11,000. One doctor wrote about his experience in Gaza, and we recently had a chance to speak to him. A word of caution, though, what you hear, you may find disturbing. And joining us now is Dr. Feroz Sidwa. He is a trauma and general surgeon who worked at the European Hospital in Khan Yunus, Gaza, for 2 weeks in the months of March and April. Doctor, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. I know that you worked with the New York Times to write a guest essay called 65 Doctors, Nurses, and Paramedics. Talk to us more about that, why you thought it was important, and a little bit more about what you saw in Gaza.
Yeah, so, when I was in Gaza, I kept a journal while I was there. That's the only reason I know this. But I saw 13 kids who had been, I'm talking about small children, not 17 and a half year olds, but pre-teenage children who had been shot in the head or the chest. And at the time, I just assumed it was the work of some local soldier who might be just a bit crazed. And I went on with my life. But then I mentioned it casually to another physician who'd worked there, and he said, yeah, I saw the same thing almost every single day. I saw a young kid shot in the head. So then I got a bit curious, and at that time I was writing an open letter to the Biden administration that was signed, this was in July, it was signed by 45 doctors and nurses who worked in Gaza. So, and basically everybody said the same thing. Yeah, anybody who worked in the appropriate setting, the ER, the OR, the ICU, they all saw the same thing. So then then after that open letter, the Times reached out to me and said, can you write something about this? So I said, sure. So we came up with the idea of polling as many healthcare workers as we could find to see what conditions they personally witnessed. And, that's the New York Times, of course, so they're interested in things that have some sort of political meaning. And I think it's kind of obvious what the meaning is if in the catchment area of every hospital in Gaza. Every day, or at least very regularly, for the past year, children have been shot in the head. That's kind of hard to dismiss as not meaning anything about what's going on there.
It's very disturbing. The essay also talked about malnutrition in Gaza. Talk to us about that. I mean, how bad is it?
there is a huge problem of severe and extreme hunger in Gaza. I couldn't give you the exact numbers right now, but it's something like at least a quarter of the population has severe food insecurity that is bad enough that their rate of death is increasing. So, you know, that's what, it's not the technical definition of a famine under the IPC rules, but it's what most people would think of as a famine when they just use the term casually. Now, when I was there, I was, like I mentioned, I was in probably the best resourced city block of all of Gaza. I still saw children that looked like that. Not, I shouldn't say looked like. I still saw children who were starving to death. The testimony from the New York Times article of the multiple healthcare workers speaks for itself. People said it was widespread. They saw plenty of people who had lost weight. Everyone's malnourished, but it's getting to the point that it is actually killing people, and probably in large numbers. But this is one of the scary things about Gaza. We actually don't know how many people are starving to death in Gaza because the Israelis won't allow independent teams in to check, and the U.S. backs them in that, in my opinion, quite unreasonable stance. So we don't even know if we're starving tens of thousands of children to death in Gaza or not. I think that's terrifying.
Dr. Sidwa, thank you for coming on and sharing all this with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, do you know how many Catholics there are in the world? The Vatican reports the numbers, and they may just surprise you. Plus, unity of the church, the most crucial topic in the synod on its third week. We have a report from Rome. The Synod in Rome has completed its third week, which has focused on governance and delegation of authority in the church. Many Synod participants have stressed that while each particular church brings a uniqueness and richness to the universal church, unity is more crucial than ever. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Sidegren has more.
La procedura dell'evento delle presenze è aperta.
The third week of the Synod closed this morning with the submitting of the smaller working group summary reports. Participation, governance, and authority are the themes the International Assembly has been working on in these past days.
We're now on the
Archbishop Anthony Fisher, one of the Synod delegates from Australia, spoke about the possibility of delegating doctrinal authority to local bishops' conferences and churches. Emphasizing the richness of the different cultures, ritual traditions, and various ways of evangelizing across the world, he stressed that our faith must remain the same and that it cannot be reinvented.
Could we, for instance, envisage a church where you have ordination of women in some countries but not in other countries, or you have same-sex marriages in some countries but not in other countries? Or you have an Arian Christology in some countries and a Nicene Christology in other. You might guess, I think no. I think that we need to have the same faith, the same morals, the same church order, and essentially the same liturgy.
The universality of the Catholic Church is well reflected in the International Synodal Assembly. In an exclusive interview with EWTN's Colin Flynn, Cardinal-elect Archbishop Tarcisius Isao Kikuchi of Tokyo explained that the very small Japanese church is also very international. While recognizing the importance of diversity, the Archbishop, whose motto is unity in diversity, expressed his desire to unite all national communities.
My policy actually is not to establish the separate community for different cultures and different languages, but I want to have the integrated community, which is very difficult. But then there are some priests and some people trying to engage other nationalities or other people to make a community together.
During one of the daily briefings, Australian theologian Father Ormond Rush focused on the importance of theology and tradition, stressing that living revelation is not just static truths, but a continuous dialogue between God and humanity. In his address, he explained that in the second session of the Synod, they are entering the process of the living tradition of the Church to actualize the message of the Gospel.
In other words, theology's role is to help the Church better achieve its primary mission, of proclaiming and bringing about God's vision for our world A vision we believe, of course, is revealed in Jesus Christ in his whole ministry and death and resurrection and the sending of the Holy Spirit, the one who is to guide the church into the future. And so this is what this synod is doing, listening to that Holy Spirit.
The work of the assembly will resume next Monday when the participants will gather for the presentation of the outline of the key points for the final document. Work on the draft will continue throughout the week before participants vote to approve the final document on Saturday. Synod participants will have a day off tomorrow before gathering again on Sunday morning in St. Peter's Square for the canonization mass for 14 new saints presided over by Pope Francis. In Rome, Benedictia de Grian, EWTN News Nightly.
And just a reminder that all next week, you can watch a one-hour recap of the Synod on Synodality right here on EWTN. Our coverage begins at 5 p.m. Eastern. And finally, tonight, a new study from the Vatican examines the Catholic population around the world. And the numbers may just surprise you. The total number of Catholics in 2022 is nearly 1.39 billion. That is more than 17% of the world population. How about that? In Europe, the numbers are falling slightly, though. There's nearly a half a million fewer Catholics than in 2021. But still, just under 285 million faithful are there. And in Africa, the Catholic population is more than 272 million. That is an increase of more than 7 million. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.